This show is pre-recorded and furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life with your host, Alan Gervy. Alan is the managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervy.
Oh, yes. Music to my ears. Hearing the Gervy Law intro. It's been a while. I've been on hiatus. This is Alan Gervy, by the way. And this is Gervy's Law. It's been a prolonged hiatus. I've been away for personal reasons. And I'm so happy to be back on KBC Radio, where I belong. And we have a great show for my first show back. Of course, I want one of my favorite guests that have been on essentially since the beginning. 10 years I've been doing the show, and Alan Dershowitz was there in the beginning. Back in those days, I used to give Alan Dershowitz this long introduction, tell him his whole life story. And I remember once he said, you know, I wish my mom could hear that. She'd be so proud of me. But today I'll give him a short intro, and he is with Rick Kuiper. And Rick Kuiper is new to the show. He's been an FBI special agent, 20 years he was an FBI special agent. He retired in 2019, and he specialized in digital forensics and cybersecurity. And we're going to talk about the Keith Ramirez case in a second. But first, I want to welcome back to the show Alan Dershowitz, who's professor emeritus at Harvard, as most people know. He's a defender of civil liberties and human rights, and he has a great podcast called Dershow, which is heard and seen on Rumble and YouTube. Alan, welcome back to Gervy's Law.
Well, thanks. Glad to have you back. I'm glad you're back from your hiatus, and I've always enjoyed being on with you.
Yeah, and I enjoy having you on. And, you know, it's been a few years, and I'll tell you, lots has gone on. And at the end, I want to save a little bit of time to ask you some questions about Israel and about Trump and a couple of the issues that you have been outspoken about. Yeah. And I appreciate a lot of your outspokenness on these issues. But let's talk first. We have Rick on the show. Rick, welcome to Gervy's Law. Nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
And we're going to start the show off talking about something really important, and that is the Keith Ramirez case. And that is something that people may have forgotten about because it's been a few years since he was convicted. And I want to hear from both of you why there is still an issue here. We're going to talk a little bit about FBI falsified evidence. And by the way, next week on my show, I have John Eastman, and he's going to talk about evidence that he believes that was falsified and manipulated regarding the election and his suspension from the practice of law. But that'll be next week. Today, let's talk about the FBI, the allegations of FBI falsifications and manipulations. Who wants to start? Alan, you want to talk about Keith Ramirez and what happened and why you're still interested amongst all these other issues you're dealing with, still interested in this case?
Yeah. 2 days ago, I actually met for the first time with Keith Ramirez. I visited with him in the Tucson Federal Prison for several hours. And I had previously, of course, studied FBI agent Kuiper's very thorough reports about the case. And I came to the conclusion that there was at the very least probable cause, and Mr. Kuiper can go beyond that, but at the very least probable cause to believe that the major piece of evidence that resulted in his conviction, a photograph with time stamps that allegedly was of a female that was underage, was tampered with, and that the dates were changed, and that, in fact, the female was not below the age of consent, and therefore that the photographing of her was not a crime at all. And I relied very heavily on the affidavits of Mr. Kuiper and other former FBI agents and experts who came to that conclusion. And what we're seeking at the very least is a thorough evidentiary hearing at which Mr. Kuiper and others can testify live, could be subject to cross-examination, and government witnesses who had access to these photographs. By the way, the chain of custody was broken, lots of issues. There were staged photographs, a range of issues. And as you probably know, I've been a specialist for, 60 years now in uncovering government manipulation of evidence. We won the O.J. Simpson case based on government manipulation of a sock, a bloody sock, which it turned out the blood was poured on the sock by Officer Van Adder. It wasn't obtained as the defendant was running through a bloody area. In the Klaus von Bülow case, we proved that family members had tampered with evidence. And I would say I've had another dozen cases that I've won where we've proved that FBI labs, that state police labs, that other prosecutorial authorities had tampered with evidence. And so this is an issue I've been deeply concerned with. And I'm even more concerned when the defendant is as unpopular as Keith Raniere. He came into the case with a horrible media portrait in which there had been show after show, article after article, portraying him as some kind of a cult mastermind. Those issues are not what I focus on. What I focus on is, did the government, in an effort to try to convict him, whatever they thought of his guilt or innocence, but did they manipulate the evidence? And if they did, every American is at risk. And so I think it's important that you get the specifics from Mr. Kuiper and know that he speaks not only for himself, but numerous others to whom I have spoken and whose affidavits I've read corroborate the notion that they're should at least be an evidentiary hearing. And if the evidence proves that Mr. Kuiper and others are correct, at the very least, there should be a new trial. But he could not be tried for the alleged child pornography because that evidence would have been permanently and forever made inadmissible and illegal. So I think it's best now to turn to Mr.
And once it's inadmissible, then perhaps there isn't the evidence to convict. I want to talk to Rick about this because, Alan, you've just given us a nice historical perspective of evidence that has been manipulated over the last 40, 50 years when you talk about going back to O.J.
And it's much worse before that. Somebody was sentenced to death. Some years ago, I used to teach this case on the basis of a prosecutor standing up in front of the jury, showing them a pair of underwear and saying, "This is the blood. This is the blood of the defendant and the victim. This is the blood." And it turned out it was paint.
Oh, my God.
And the prosecutor knew it was paint. And somebody was sentenced to death on the basis of a prosecutor falsely representing that paint was blood. And so who will guard the guardians? Who will prosecute the prosecutors? That's been a core aspect of my career since I started practicing and teaching 60 years ago.
You know, just listening to that, it makes me think that there's a bigger issue here, and that has to do with the human condition, honesty, integrity, loyalty, all kinds of values that apparently are not in existence in the legal system, which I find every day as a practicing trial attorney, battling the same issues that you're talking about, and you shake your head and think, how do people get away with this? How do this...
Well, because most law enforcement people are honest, decent, and have integrity. It's the few bad apples, and because so many of them are good, that you start out with the presumption that this is a former, this is an FBI agent, this is a police officer, this is a Los Angeles police officer. He's going to be telling the truth. You start out with that presumption, and the small, relatively small number of bad apples destroy that presumption and make you
the skeptic that
I've become.
And I want to ask Rick, how are they prevailing? And you may be right. I think let's hope, as far as the human condition goes, that it is a minority. It's a small minority, but when they're prevailing in justice, that's the problem.
But I want to make one other point before we turn to Rick. Where is the fault? The fault lies with the judges. The judges who refuse to grant evidentiary hearings, the judges who cover up, the judges who will not look into these issues, they are the guardians of our legal system. And in this case, the judge has adamantly refused to hear from Mr. Kuiper and others. And so I want your listeners to understand who the real villains are.
No,
here.
You know,
they are the judges.
I have got to agree fullheartedly. I see these judges all the time. I'm not going to say names, but I could. And I will tell you how frustrating it is. Some of them have bad days. Some of them are just rotten people. Some of them have agendas. Some of them have the judge-itis, the black robe-itis. They want to prevail. They want to be arrogant. And yet the justice system somehow permits this to happen with appeals that the judges don't necessarily get overturned, and you may have another bad apple as a judge. So I completely agree, because I deal with it and face it every day of my career. Rick, from the FBI perspective, 20 years as a special agent, how is this happening? Can you comment on what Alan has talked about?
First of all, I agree with absolutely everything both of you said with regards to the process and the way it should play out. And also the judges, really, it's incredible to me how they can overlook these things. But what can we attribute to the FBI? Well, we know that the FBI definitely mishandled the evidence. They broke the chain of custody. There are people that handled the evidence that are not in the chain of custody. There are people that are on the chain of custody that had no authority to look at the evidence. We know that the evidence was accessed without a write blocker, and in other words, without any sort of protection against manipulating the evidence. We know the evidence was accessed and changed during.
Who is changing this evidence in the Keith Raniere case, for instance? Who's changing the evidence?
Well, you know, this is incredible. What I'm about to tell you. And this just occurred in one of the findings and one of the responses from the government. There is a camera card that's one of two pieces of evidence used in this case, one of two pieces of digital evidence, okay? So you have this camera card. This camera card we looked at the report from the FBI, because they never turned over the card to the defense, and they never even turned over a forensic copy of that card to the defense. So all we had to work with, me and the other examiners in this case, were the FBI's reports. And according to the FBI's reports, that card was accessed and changed 6 months after it was seized from the FBI. And when we raised this issue, the response from the government, the response for the government is this, and I'd just like to read this as a quote, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Here's what the government said. This access was not the result of law enforcement tampering, as Raniere's motion claims. Rather, having no reason to believe that the metadata of the contents of the camera card had any evidentiary value, law enforcement agents directed that a photograph technician copy the photographs from the camera card in order to provide the photographs more expeditiously to defense counsel. So here we have this unnamed, unidentified photograph technician who messed with the card, who's not on the chain of custody, who was never examined by the defense or his or her credentials challenged by the defense. None of that occurred. And to this day, they won't admit who it was and what exactly they did with that card. And to this day, they refuse to turn over the forensic image or the forensic copy of that particular piece of evidence. It's outrageous.
It is outrageous. Alan, as a lawyer, don't you feel that lawyers should be able to advocate on behalf of their clients in such a way that this shouldn't happen? Like, why are the judges prevailing? Why are the bad apples in the FBI and investigators prevailing? Why can't a lawyer do his or her job and convince either a judge or a jury that this occurred as Rick said it did?
Because the judges won't let them, and too many defense lawyers refuse to stand up to judges. These ought to be challenged at every point. I remember a case where I said that the government had engaged in misconduct, and the judge threatened me with contempt, And I said, Your Honor, you have your job to do. I have my job to do. And my job is to expose government corruption. I'm going to continue to do it. And if you want to hold me in contempt, that's your job. But don't tell me my job. And we did expose the corruption. We won the case. The Circuit Court of Appeals commended me.
Is that
for
gonna...
being persistent in exposing the corruption? But that's rare.
And pursuing the corruption, because a lot of times lawyers will move on to their next case, and there's a lot going on, so you kind of forget about it. But apparently, you two have not forgotten about Keith Raniere, and we want to know, Alan. You said you met with him.
I did, yeah.
And what is your role going to be, and how did that meeting go, without disclosing any attorney-client privilege, if that's the case?
Of course. First, it was hard for me to get the meeting. He has been denied access to his counsel. I was the first lawyer to see him in 7 months. Generally, you can see your lawyers almost on a once-a-week basis, but they've kept Raniere in the shoe. In the security area, they put him into a very difficult to reach place in Arizona, and we today just filed a letter with the warden asking to have more access for me to have a monthly phone call with him, and for his lawyers who are in the Tucson, Arizona area to be able to have regular access to him. But at the moment, he's been denied access, and he seemed remarkably calm. Considering the fact that he's been sentenced to, 125 years?
120 years.
In prison? 120 years. And the reason he was this photograph. If not for this photograph, his defense that everybody who he was involved with did it voluntarily, and they were all adults, would have been very easy to accept by a jury. But once you have an allegation that he was taking photographs of somebody below the age of consent, that changes everything. And what we're asking for is a trial in which that evidence, tampered evidence.
Alan and Rick, it wasn't simply the photographs that would turn a sentence into 120 years. Apparently, people felt that he was duping them, that he was illegally causing them to do things that they didn't want to do. So how do you look at the rest of the case? Because let's assume that this evidence can be figured out and all the manipulations can be reversed. But again, people said that he ruined a lot of people's lives. Did you find that when you were speaking to him? Were you afraid of him?
Oh, not at all. He seemed like a soft-spoken person. Didn't seem like he was manipulative or able to persuade people to do things they didn't want. Look, when it comes to these kinds of encounters, there's no explaining why some people go along. There are psychological needs that are satisfied. But my only point is this. Everything changed with that photograph. There have been many cases where people – I've done another case involving somebody who was accused of similar conduct. We got that reversed on appeal, and then there was a plea bargain and a relatively low sentence. And so the key is, would there have been a conviction at all without this photograph? And based on my 6 years of experience, I can tell you there's no more damning piece of evidence that you can ever find than child pornography. And if that child pornography was not child pornography, it was above the age of consent, that there has to be a start all over again.
And Rick, I assume you would agree with that. What is going to be your role in this? You know, Alan's trying to be able to meet with Keith Raniere on a regular basis, perhaps a new trial, looking at the evidence. As an expert and a retired FBI special agent, how can you play a role in this turnaround, if there is a turnaround?
Right. A great question. And I neglected to mention at the beginning that not only was I an examiner with the FBI, a forensic examiner with a team called the Computer Analysis Response Team, or CART, but I was also an instructor of that program. I developed a curriculum in that program, and I actually taught the teachers of that program. So It's especially outrageous to me knowing how these examiners were supposed to conduct themselves, how they're supposed to safeguard the evidence that and the processes and procedures that they violated along the way. I mean, we're talking about an examiner receiving evidence in an unsealed container so just that, and then testifying in court that, oh, that's no big deal. That's a huge deal.
Yeah.
When you're receiving digital evidence and it's not even sealed, you don't know who touched it, who accessed it before you did. The fact that we have the government admitting that because they didn't believe the metadata for the camera card was important, they gave it to some unnamed photo technician who actually altered the evidence. I mean, metadata was their entire case. If you look at these photographs, these alleged child pornography photographs, and I have not, but I've been told that the person that's depicted there looks like an adult. You cannot bring a witness and determine from the pictures that it's child pornography. So they 100% relied on the metadata, these timestamps, when these pictures were supposedly taken, where that person was 15 years old.
Right.
Okay.
Well, you know,
and there was only 22 of these pictures out of, you know, thousands. So, the fact that on one hand they completely relied on the metadata for convicting, and then on the other hand they say, well, metadata is not important, so we gave this key piece of evidence to somebody who altered it, it's incredible to me that I even read that in their.
Well, you know. It's really interesting, and it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out. And both of you, I think, are doing something that's really important, and I think Alan touched on it before, is looking at due process and looking at justice and being able to hopefully use this case as an example of how to look at this evidence, this data, and make sure that it's real, accurate, and not fabricated. So I wish you both luck as we move forward.
Thanks. Right. Who has an interest in anybody being convicted on the basis of false evidence? Nobody.
Society has
not a judge.
Exactly.
We all want to make sure that if he is to be convicted, it has to be based on untampered with evidence. And there should be nobody who is opposed to exposing what really happened.
Absolutely.
Justice Brandeis once put it, sunlight is the best disinfectant. So let's have a sunlight hearing.
That's right. And we're hoping that'll take place in this case, but I really only have a couple minutes left. Alan, a couple quick questions. We're talking about sunlight. Can you bring some sunlight onto this Israel situation when you have recently said that you drew a red line and you're concerned that the Democrats are going to abandon Israel and that will impact the entirety of the world and the freedom that the Americans have. Tell us in the last couple minutes about your thoughts
on
that.
I just came back from Israel, where I met with the prime minister, the president, military leaders, the head of the Mossad, and I came away with two clear conclusions. Number one, there is no famine in Gaza. Even the UN says maybe in June there'll be a famine. There's hunger. People are having one meal or two meals instead of three meals a day, all the fault of Hamas. They've stolen the food. They've stolen the grain. They've stolen the medicine. They're using babies and children as human shields. And how the United States could consider abandoning Israel because it made one terrible mistake with the World Kitchen. Remember, the United States made a much worse mistake in the exit from Afghanistan. They went after somebody who they thought was a terrorist. It turns out he was an AIDS worker. They killed him and his whole family. I think there were seven or eight innocent people killed.
Alan, by the way, I just have to say this. Alan, I have to say this. They admitted to the mistake. How many countries around the world admit to a mistake? Did Hamas admit to the mistake in October? I don't think so. Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, let me give you one other fact. Just yesterday, one of the hostages revealed that she was kidnapped not by Hamas, but by Gazan civilians. He took her back to Gaza with cheering civilians, jubilated at the fact that they had gotten this nurse, this innocent nurse, after killing seven or eight of her kibbutz mates in cold blood. These were civilians, and the civilians were the ones who were cheering. The civilians were the ones who provided human shields, the civilians. You know, it's interesting. I recently obtained a letter from Albert Einstein, who talked about the complicity of good Germans in what happened in the Holocaust because they didn't do anything about it. So when you hear that there are Gazan civilians, think about the civilians who captured this nurse. Think about the civilians who allow their homes to be used for rocket launching. Think about the civilians who finance Hamas. Think about the civilians who cheer. Think about the 70% of the civilians in Gaza who support what Hamas did on October 7th. Those are the so-called civilians.
All right, Alan, we appreciate it. I wish we had more time. Rick Kuiper, Alan Dershowitz, thank you so much for being with us today on Gervie's Law. So much to talk about, and we'll catch up another time. That's going to have to do it today. We're out of time. Thanks for listening.